Imagine a justice system built on rigorous evidence, not gut instincts or educated guesses about what works and what doesn't. More people could access the civil justice they deserve. The criminal justice system could be smaller, more effective, and more humane. The Access to Justice Lab here at Harvard Law School is producing that needed evidence, and this podcast is about the challenge of transforming law into an evidence-based field. I'm your host, Jim Greiner, and this is Proof Over Precedent.
Shannon, welcome. As you know, I'm Jim Greiner, and I'm the faculty director of the Access to Justice Lab. And you are a longtime professional acquaintance of mine, and as a result, a friend of mine, because of the, among other things, the number of problems that I've caused you and that you have helped me solve going through various randomized experiments in the field. So why don't we ask you to begin with, who are you? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you, Jim, and thank you for the opportunity. So my name is Shannon Sewards. I've been doing IRB work for over 20 years, and I'm currently at an academic medical center in the northern New England area. And previous to that, I was at Harvard, as well as other IRBs on the West Coast.
And when you were previously at Harvard, what was your position at Harvard?
Yeah, so I was the director of the IRB at Harvard, as I am now and at previous institutions as well.
And one of the things that made me put me permanently in your fan club is that that you saved my career in multiple instances. That is not an overstatement. I would not be able to do the type of work that I am doing, 100% of my research time, if you hadn't taken the position that you did at Harvard. If time allows, we might discuss the fact that there were, how should we put this in corporate speak? There were significant challenges in the Harvard IRB as it existed prior to your arrival. And you spent, a good 5 or 6 years addressing those challenges before you were able to put things into ship shape and then start doing even more constructive things after that. So I'm eternally grateful to you.
Well, thank you.
For all of the work that you've done. Thank you. So, and you said, you've already answered, you said you've been involved with IRBs for about 20 years. Is that right?
Yep, that is right.
And what brought you to this area? This is not, many people, and in fact, one of the reasons we're doing this podcast is many people haven't heard of IRBs, don't know what they are, or if they have heard of them in the legal community, they are scared to death or find the whole thing, oh gosh, I don't know what that is. So we're going to try to demystify them. How did you get involved with IRBs?
I was on the other side. I was a research coordinator. I was working on a couple different research studies, and my task was to put in the IRB submission. So I would take the grant and then IRBize it into the submission. And it was, the standard relationship that most researchers have with IRBs is it's not a friendly relationship. And you're always wondering what the IRB is going to critique, why they're asking you to do something. There's often no justification or rationale provided, just basically do it. And so I was really frustrated with how IRBs operated. And one thing that I did enjoy doing was actually creating an IRB submission. I always found it very challenging, because you're taking basically conceptual concepts and implementing logistics and what it would be like from the perspective of anyone that took part. So you really had to think outside the box a lot of times in order to put these submissions together. And it was always sort of a challenge to, get in a submission with few responses back. That was considered a win. So with that, I decided, let's give IRB World a shot. And so I had my very first IRB position as an IRB analyst and started reviewing studies. It was definitely challenging, but it also gave me insight into some of the challenges that IRBs face, as well as to rethink how IRBs operate and, to be more transparent, to provide justification, to provide rationale, to partnership, with the research community and to be seen as a shepherd through the compliance process rather than a hindrance. So that's my ethos of the IRB world and what I've tried to implement at IRBs that I've been at.
And for what it's worth, again, speaking as a researcher, you were spectacularly successful at it, and allowed researchers, among other things, to anticipate and solve problems with you and with IRBs in ways that I can already tell, since you left Harvard, have become challenging for the new Harvard regime. So it is not it is a, it is a, it is a real skill. We're going to shift to some basics here for folks that are unfamiliar with the IRB system, where if it's all right, we walk through those. Before we do that, though, I can't resist. Tell us one fun fact about yourself. Tell us one thing that you like to do or something interesting or fun about yourself, and then we'll move on to these basics.
Well, as you know, and much to your chagrin, I like to spend a lot of time outdoors, whether that be skiing or camping or hiking. That's definitely a real passion of mine, to be in nature. So I guess that could be a fun fact.
I like to be in nature too. I just like to be lazy while I'm being in nature. So skiing and camping, as opposed to, lying flat somewhere warm, is where I think we differ. But anyway, okay, super. So let's talk through some of these ba some basics. First of all, IRB is an acronym. What does it stand for, and what is it? What is an IRB?
So it stands for Institutional Review Board. And
Which sounds terrifying.
it does, it does.
Right.
So basically, the IRB is a panel of individuals from various areas, various experience, areas of expertise, people from an institution, whether that institution be an academic institution or a hospital, or it could even be a business, could have their own IRB. But really, what the intent is to get this group of individuals together to review and approve research according to the federal regulations that govern human subject protections. So that's in short what an IRB is. The IRB office is the set of people that actually operate the IRB to ensure that things go smoothly and to ensure that the office and the panel remain compliant and according to the federal regulations. And depending on how the office is set up, some IRB office staff may also be considered IRB members. And not only attend those panel meetings, but they also might review research studies that are no greater than minimal risk, as well as some other determinations that are part of the federal regulations.
Terrific. So organizationally, then there's the board, and then there's what we could colloquially call staff, implementation staff, right? And sometimes the you know that sometimes under certain organizations, staff can sit on the board, sometimes not, depending on the organization. And both are tied to a particular institution. In other words, there is, as you said, you used to be the head of the Harvard IRB. There is one for Harvard. There would be another one for another university. There might be, as you said, one for a business, but they're tied to particular institutions. Is that all correct?
That is correct. However, it's not an absolute requirement. Lately, there have been a lot of what are called commercial IRBs, and these are IRBs that are in existence to provide an IRB review. They mostly review FDA regulated research, and they're available for pharmaceutical companies, device companies. Typically, they come in handy with large clinical trials and so forth. And those are independent of an institution. The only thing that they do provide is IRB services for anyone that wants to use them.
And then presumably you pay them, right? You pay, in other words,
Oh, yes.
they're businesses, right, that provide the
Correct.
service, right?
Correct.
And then another sort of basic thing that piece of terminology here about is something called the common rule, which is the fact that it is singular is itself misleading. But what is the common rule, even though we call it singular, we say it's a singular verb, I mean singular noun, excuse me. What is the common rule?
So the common rule is the set of regulations under Health and Human Services, Department of Health and Human Services, that are applied to any research that receives federal funding. And it's called the common rule because many, not all, but many of the federal agencies have signed on to adopt those regulations with any research that involves human subjects, which also have very specific definitions. So if you're getting money from NIH, you must have the common rule. It's at 45 CFR 46, applied to your research.
And specifically, it's part A of 45 CFR
It
46. Is
is.
that correct? There are four parts. We're going to get into this whole law nerd thing where we're going to be citing some pieces of the CFR. But
Perfect.
there's A, B, C, and D of 45
Correct.
CFR 46. The common rule specifically refers to part A. Is
That
that
is
correct?
correct. That
And
is correct.
you mentioned that compliance is mandatory for federally funded research. However, effectively, the sweep of the common rule is broader than federally funded research and practice. Is that correct?
That is correct. So this is all bound in an agreement known as the Federal Wide Assurance. So FWA, that it's also known as, is basically a contract between the feds and the institution to assure that if you are receiving federal funds for research, that you're going to apply these standards, these regulations to your research and have an IRB review it according to those standards. And on the FWA, there used to be an option to say it was called, did you check the box or not? And if you did check the box, basically that said that you would apply these principles, these standards to all research regardless of funding. If you did not check the box, then you would technically only apply it to federally funded research. Now, the thing where it gets a little bit interesting is that the federal regulations are a great map, a roadmap to apply ethical principles, right? And they're founded in the Belmont Report, which is more of the, conceptual ethical principles.
And we're going to talk some more. I'm going to ask you some more about that in a
Yes.
minute, but go on. Yep.
Yeah. But the common rule really is a nice laid out map for how to apply the regulations. It has different definitions of what is research, what is a human subject, different review levels. It's really sort of the Belmont Report operationalized in a way. So most institutions who have an IRB, that IRB will apply the federal regulations regardless of funding, even though they might not have checked the box, because it's just easy to do. The reason for not checking the box is that if you are audited, that the federal government can only audit studies that are federally funded.
But if you do check the box, they can get their federal fingers into everything.
Everything. And there was a change with the 2018 big revision that happened to the regs regarding the box and whether to check it. But generally, that's how IRBs apply the common rules to most research, but they limit what can be audited per their FWA.
So again, even if they don't check the box, even if in a university, say, or an institution doesn't check the box, it often applies the common rule to the research, to non-federally funded research anyway.
Exactly, because you really want to have, research that is reviewed in the same manner. Now, interestingly enough, about 10 years ago, there was a huge movement to find flexibility for those studies that were not federally funded. So you would have IRBs that would create, additional review categories or extended approval periods, et cetera, for those studies that were not federally funded. And that gave you the option of implementing that flexibility. It sounds like a great idea. In practice, it was really challenging because you had to apply different principles depending on how the study was funded. So even though there is a little bit around, you'll still hear about flexibility. I think most people have just sort of reverted to applying the common rule as is.
And this is going to be a point we're going to return to later, then, is that because the common rule is governing federally funded, non-federally funded research effectively for in most, certainly in most universities, and probably and actually in most research period, because the federal government funds so much of it, and also because the common rule lives in HHS. In other words, it is in a the folks that are writing it, revising it from time to time, is Health and Human Services. Their focus is medical. And from its origin story, because we'll talk about this, the Belmont Report came out in response, partial response to scandals that occurred as a result of medical research. The perspective is distinctly medical. Is that fair as well? The overall dominating perspective is distinctly medical.
I agree with you 100%. The default position for the common rule is that it will be a clinical trial that involves adults and that you'll get consent. And if you have a research study that varies from that default model, there's a lot of work that you have to do on the back end in order to document how it differs. So if you're not getting consent, you'd have to issue a waiver. If you're involving children, there's the specific subpart that applies to children, et cetera. So the other challenging thing too, and if you look specifically at the subparts, with prisoners or with inclusion of pregnant women, it's really focused on, how might a drug affect them, or really looking at it through the lens of medical research and the harms and the risk that might occur of medical research in those specific populations. And so if you're, an IRB that mostly reviews social, behavioral, or educational research, it's really quite challenging because how is it even applicable? But yet you're still required to look through the research with that lens.
And this is, in fact, part of the reason why you and I became friends, is because, in fact, in law, we're not typically randomizing whether there will be a drug, or whether there will be a treatment on the body of the individual, on the physical self of the individual. Instead, there's something else going on at law, the sorts of things that we
Correct.
do in law. And we're going to talk about, time permitting and your patience permitting, Shannon, we're going to talk about some situations in which the Access to Justice Labs randomized field experiments have demonstrated potential problems with the way the common rule is written. Where in a couple of cases, I think, at least I think that if you follow the letter of the common rule, you get to perfectly absurd results. You get to things that no one would ever want to have happen, or
Correct.
inquiries that make absolutely no sense. And we'll talk about those. And I think one of the origin, one of the reasons why that's true is because the assumption of the authors of this rule is that the research is medical.
That is true. And there is a lot of, discussion among the non-medical community about why do we even have these regulations applied to us? How does this even fit?
For what it's worth, and I actually want to get this out early if it's okay, just in case people get the impression that as I ask questions that probe some of the poor fit of the common rule to legal research, field research, and maybe to non-medical research generally, if people get the impression that I personally, or even most people that do the sorts of things that they're dabbling in the sorts of things the Access to Justice Lab does, think there should be no regulations, that's wrong. As we'll talk about, actually, I'd like to ask you about next when I ask about the origin of the common rule. There are too many horror stories in which researchers have abused research participants, that they have acted unethically. And the fact that they are professionals, so quote unquote, or have extensive educations, have long resumes, whatever, has not in any way prevented them from acting in ethically horrific ways. And so, I have throughout my, 15, 20 years of doing this type of work, repeatedly craved your guidance, and craved the guidance of IRBs generally, in making sure that the studies that are being are implemented is being done in an ethical way. So it's not that there should be no review. It's just that there may need to be some changes in the way the regulations are operating. But before we get to the changes, let's get to how things are now. It is called the Common Rule because many agencies basically reprint Part A of 45 CFR 46 in their own regulatory structures. Is that accurate? They basically just copy and paste the whole thing and stick it in a different part of the CFR.
Exactly. And the common rule is really the floor. Any agency can add additional requirements. For example, a lot of agents like Department of Defense has a lot of additional requirements. Department of Justice has a lot of additional requirements as well, but they have the common principles of applied to the research plus.
And that was contemplated, if I'm correct, that was contemplated from the beginning. In other words, the idea was that HHS was going to take the lead and promulgate a set of principles that the other agencies were going to be able to adopt as much as possible in order to create something uniform across the federal government. Is that accurate?
That is correct.
And so do the Common Rule and IRBs have something of a joint origin story? In other words, where did they come from? Where did IRBs come from, and where did the Common Rule come from?
Basically, it was a reaction to things that went bad. There was the National Commission that was formed, and there was also the Belmont Report. A lot of, there's the Beecher article that was seminal to really distinguish between clinical practice and research, because I think those were conflated with.
Let's actually talk about this. These are the I do happen to have some dates. These is roughly in the early 1970s that a lot of this is occurring, which
Correct.
is surprising to me because of how recent that is. There had been research that had been going on, randomized, real large randomized field experiments date back to World War II. And many people date the first ones to the UK and then the United States, and the streptomycin field experiments. Right around World War II. So we've got 30 years before we start getting a serious regulatory structure. And then we get, and during those 30 years, we get some horror stories. Is that accurate?
That is very accurate. And I think, in regard to how research was overseen, it was mostly done by the institution. You could think of it more of a scientific review than an actual application of federal regulation, looking at, what is the consent process? Who are your populations? Are they vulnerable? Are they do, could there be coercion, et cetera? Those more minute details were not necessarily considered, which is what the federal regulations actually do in a more comprehensive way. But to say that research was not reviewed, it was, but it wasn't to the extent that we are required to do so now. And a lot of the bad things that occurred might be in part due to that.
And so it's also surprising to me that a mentor of mine, Charles Fried, wrote a critical book in the early 1970s about medical experimentation. But he wrote it in, again, the key point is the date. He wrote it in 1970, and so the field of research ethics, especially medical research ethics, is relatively young. It's only about 50 years old. That's
That's
also
correct.
accurate. Yeah. During between the 1940s and the 1970s, some of those horror stories include the Nazi experimentation.
Correct.
Like so much else with the Nazis, it's hard to think of that as related to anything else. It's so horrific, that it's, you could almost, if you wanted to, try to put it in its own category and then ignore it in terms of other day-to-day applications, just because, which, I would never recommend, by the way. But people sometimes react and say, oh, that's the Nazis. They did horrible things. Then that's their lesson. But then we also had federally funded examples of horrific abuse of participants. And so Tuskegee, for example, is a with the syphilis studies, that may be an example that people have heard of.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And there were also studies done in South America that were
Yes.
federally funded as well. So it's not just the Nazis.
No, and that's, I think, a key lesson is that, the Nazis were the people who were doing it were the professional class of the intelligentsia of the Nazi regime. Again, this idea, and then the federally funded research, again, deploying medical professionals doing these horrific things. None of the identity-based arguments, in other words, work. In other words, because we're the federal government, we won't do horrible things. That doesn't work. We've got counterexamples of that. Because we're educated, we won't do horrible things. That doesn't work either. Right. In other words, you just have to have this layer of review.
And I think that an important point too is that as I previously mentioned, the common rule is based in the principles of the Belmont Report. And if you look at what those principles are, respect for persons, beneficence, and justice, those really came out of those atrocities. And what should be in place if anyone wants to take part, you should know what the risks are. You should have the decision and the information available to make an informed decision. It should be autonomous. You shouldn't unnecessarily be targeted to take place in research because of all the research that took place in prisons and orphanages and other areas where people really didn't have the option to take part and really looking at that risk-benefit ratio. So those are all foundational concepts that lay the groundwork for the common rule, which is very important to remember.
And so again, let's just to define some of these ideas, or just to define some of these key reference points. The Tuskegee experiment was a syphilis experiment in which the researchers, in some instances, left African American men deliberately untreated for syphilis over decades, despite the fact that there was an effective treatment for syphilis.
Yes.
We get the Willowbrook studies that are basically hepatitis B or hepatitis, I think it's hepatitis B studies in which there may have been, I think there was, deliberate infection of children who were effectively incarcerated in the Willowbrook facility.
Correct.
And then the federally funded research in South America, I believe, am I right that some of that was on radiation? Treatment. I can't actually remember, but so I think that may be accurate. And then we get the Beecher report or the Beecher article, excuse me, which was a documentation of several, maybe a couple dozen different unethically conducted research studies funded by the federal government. And we say Congress gets involved and says, yeah, it's 22 examples of unethically or questionably ethical studies in the Beecher article. And then we get Congress and the Surgeon General starting to say enough is enough. This can't go on. And we get a national commission, and then we get again what you've mentioned, the Belmont Report coming from that process. And as you mentioned, there are the three principles coming out of the Belmont Report. What were those three principles again?
Respect for persons.
Mm-hmm.
People have the autonomy to make decisions on their own behalf with sufficient information. Beneficence, really looking at that risk harm ratio, risk benefit ratio, excuse me, and justice, that there should not be one specific population that has to bear the burdens of research for all.
And
So,
yeah, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
no, please.
Well, I was going to say that one specific population, believe it or not, that becomes a problem in law, which is what we'll talk about. So, for example, a key point, as you mentioned earlier, was the propensity of researchers, medical researchers, to try to do research in incarcerated populations just because they were convenient. They were unlikely to be able to say no. Even if they could say no, they were unlikely to say no because they thought that they had to, or they were, their choices were limited. And because they were incarcerated, it was easy for medical researchers to follow up on them.
Yes.
And that struck, I think per correctly, that struck people as exploitative and just overall icky. On the other hand, in law, we may want to do research about how to safely decarcerate or reduce the ability or reduce the reliance on the criminal justice system on incarceration, in which case we can't do that on a general population. Does that make sense?
It does. And there will be circumstances where there is a specific population that the research may be, focused on and provide the rationale for why that is the case. There might be a specific condition that happens more often in one population than another. So that's perfectly reasonable to specify that specific population. So it's not to say that you cannot, that there It's not permissible to focus in on a specific population, but you have to provide a rationale for why you are.
So we get the Belmont report again, and they're still talking sort of early 1970s here, and then it takes a while. And then in 1981, roughly, we get HHS promulgating the Common Rule in its earliest version. And as you mentioned, the Common Rule attempts to operationalize these principles of the Belmont report. How does it do so, roughly, big picture speaking? How does the Common Rule generally operationalize the principles of the Belmont report?
I think if you look at the criteria for approval that IRBs must follow in order to approve any specific research study that is considered non-exempt. I don't want to get too far in the
Well,
regulatory
we're going to
weeds.
actually get there, but let's don't start
Okay.
there. That's right. Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
Go on.
Yeah, so the criteria for approval, is there a consent process? Will it be documented? Is there any coercive language in there? What is that risk benefit, ratio? It really goes through in a systematic way what is required. It's very suitable for a checklist. It's that operationalized.
And actually, a key point there is that going one step more general, a key point to the Common Rule was that there was be these things called IRBs. There had to be these things called IRBs, and that the IRBs had to review on a study by study basis. There had to be a review of each study. Up until then, that was not required by federal law. It may have been done in some instances. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it was mostly done by peers, colleagues of the researcher at any particular institution. I think, not only did the Common Rule operationalize these very important ethical principles, but it also created the IRB that is comprised of people from different walks of life, different viewpoints, different background, people from the institution, people from the community, people that may actually take part in this research. So it's this more holistic review of what the research study is, rather than just a scientific panel saying, "This looks good, Bob. Why don't you go ahead and do it?" So it's definitely more thoroughly looked at. We have, a systematic way of looking at the study, ethical principles to apply. And also, the IRB itself is interesting because it is an autonomous decision-making body, in that if an IRB that is part of an institution, if an IRB disapproves a study, the institution cannot approve it. That's the final say. So it acts as a gatekeeper, for these ethical principles.
If for the lawyers in the audience or for legally inclined folks in the audience, there is no appeal. The IRB is basically that's the final word, and you have to persuade the board, or sometimes, as we'll talk about, persuade staff that the study can go forward. Otherwise, it can't go forward. I mean, it really is just the board's the final word, and that's by design. The point is to try to insulate the board from institutional pressures. To
Exactly.
proceed with studies that might, be ethically suspect. We say no, we're going to have some, and it's a sufficiently separate entity.
Yeah. Although that isn't to say that a researcher cannot come to the IRB and say, hey, there's an aspect you may not have thought about during your review. So I would say that most IRBs are open to that, that it just may not have been relayed to them a very important aspect that wasn't considered. So there is a slight appeal
There's a
process.
conversation between the researcher and the or the researchers and the IRB, but nevertheless, the IRB has the final say. That aspect that you mentioned of coming to the IRB and saying, "Hey, there may be things that you haven't thought about." One of the things you educated me on is that is best done prior to the submission of the study. In other words, that conversation is best done. So for folks who are listening to this, who are thinking, I'm listening to this because maybe I'm thinking about doing this kind of work and I need to know what IRBs are and how they operate. It is if the IRB is receptive to it, and you were, you and your staff were, it's often best to try to work that stuff out in advance.
Agreed. And I think that there are limitations to who's part of an IRB and how that study will be reviewed. And I think the legal system, not a lot of people have experience with the legal system who sit on an IRB, that it can be challenging to review that research. And there is the option of having a consultant at the IRB meeting to provide advice on guidance on any particular area, especially if that lack of experience is present within the membership. However, some IRBs just don't use that option.
I wish they would. In many, many situations, this is one of the things we'll talk about too, time permitting, is that there are also some things that we take advantage, often things we take advantage of in law, that are I misspoke actually. Let me try that again. There are often things that we take for granted in law, that are unfamiliar to IRBs, who are used to reviewing medical research day to day, for example.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that most people learn about the legal system through television and
Right.
movies, which is not always
No,
representative of what actually happens.
that doesn't that not always too accurate. But so again, back to the basic way the common rule implements the Belmont report. There's the requirement basically of informed consent or a waiver, and then there's the IRB review, and we've talked about both of those a little bit. And then there's an institutional assurance of compliance. In other words, the institution is the one that basically has to police its own research within limits to which it, in the sense that it has to report on that policing, be subject to audits, and those sorts of things. Can you talk a little bit about that institutional assurance of compliance?
The federal-wide assurance?
Yes.
Well, the federal-wide assurance is, it's an interesting document in that it's not only a contract between the feds and the institution that is conducting the research of receiving federal funds, but it also defines what the institution is. And, for example, at Harvard, Harvard has three FWAs, even though it's known collectively as Harvard University,
FWA means, sorry, go ahead. What
the
is FW?
federal-wide assurance.
Yeah, Federalized Assurance, exactly. Go ahead.
Exactly. So even though collectively it's known as Harvard, but legally, according to the federal-wide assurance, it is the campus in Cambridge, the medical school and dental school, and then the School of Public Health. So they are all separate entities. So it really defines what the institution is. It also lists the IRB that will provide review for the institution, whether that's an internally designated IRB, or if you're using a commercial IRB for that purpose, you would list it on your federal-wide assurance as well. And basically, that you will follow the common rule, when applicable. If things go wrong, you'll report it to the federal agency to which it applies. You also ensure, compliance. So there's a lot to the federal-wide assurance.
Proof Over Precedent is a production of the Access to Justice Lab at Harvard Law School. Views expressed in student podcasts are not necessarily those of the A to J Lab. Thanks for listening. If we piqued your interest, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Even better, leave us a rating or share an episode with a friend or on social media. Here's a sneak preview of what we'll bring you next week.
If the person didn't drive to the courthouse, and there's no other place for them to leave their phone,
then they're in a real bind because they can't enter the courthouse with their cell phone, and they also have nowhere to put it. And so what we've seen is people putting their cell phones in bushes outside of courthouses. There's one fun anecdote in the blog post that accompanies this podcast about people burying their cell phones in the ground because they felt that someone would steal the phone out of the bush, which is a real thing that's been happening.